Hello and welcome to the Majlis, the podcast by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Central Asia. I am Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. So the big day is over. The Central Asian leaders indeed met. Some of the issues we discussed in our previous Majlis last week were indeed discussed. That includes water, energy, and other aspects of bilateral relations. Talking about the outcome, though, which will be today's primary topic, the fact that these leaders resumed their collective meetings without presence of any foreign leader is in itself a big outcome. But throughout the discussion, we will also look into some of other outcomes, such as the details on energy and water talks, takeaways for individual leaders who were present and the one who was not present. And also today's news, the development, surprise development, I just said, the meeting between Serdar, son of Berdimuhamedov, and Nazarbayev. That will also be on our agenda today. So discuss all these questions in today's Majlis. We have a great lineup. From New York, we have Alex Cooley, who is the director of Harriman Institute at the Columbia University. He is author of many books, including most recently Dictators Without Borders. From UK, we have Lokan Chesci, chairman of Central Asia Studies Center at the University of Glasgow. He is also author of a book on Turkmenistan's neutrality. Dr. Helene Thibault is joining us from Kazakhstan. She is a political science lecturer there at the Nazarbayev University. Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog. Kishlok Owozi is with us from Prague. Thank you, colleagues, for taking time to do this today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Very nice to have you. So it's exciting to see Central Asian leaders are again talking to each other. But apart from the excitement, Bruce, maybe we can start with you. What has this summit really achieved?
Well, I mean, if you want to look at what they did on paper, it really wasn't much. But as you suggested, the fact that they could all get together and agree that they would do this annually, always before Nawruz, I think is a big step in the right direction. And the meeting seemed to be overwhelmingly positive all the time. I mean, there was no disagreement, at least that I saw in any of the reports that I read, about anything. You know, I mean, it shows how little they've been able to accomplish together, that the same topics that were on the table yesterday were on the table more than 20 years ago: security, water use, shared energy resources, things like that, you know. But they're going into this with a much better attitude than the leaders of the 1990s did. So, you know, I look at this as a huge success.
Okay. Now, how the Kazakhstan is looks into this, Helene, what the local leaders are talking about the outcome?
Yeah, it's actually very interesting. As I was browsing the news to get information about this particular meeting, which is, as you said, something very, very special, very significant to Central Asia, it didn't receive a lot of media attention here in Kazakhstan. There were some news reports yesterday that talked about emphasizing the role of Nazarbayev as the host, of this very important meeting. But at the same time, the declarations that were made were a bit evasive, and interestingly emphasizing, the importance of Nawruz, this spring celebration that is coming up as something that is an important cultural heritage. So there was not so much discussions about politics, but more about friendship and cooperation. Although maybe we will come back on this issue later, but there was also, in terms of politics, an emphasis on the issue of security for Central Asia. Especially Nazarbayev highlighted the critical issue of fighters from Central Asia who joined ISIS, but who are about to return. But I guess we'll come back on this later, probably. But
definitely we will get to that. Alex, what was your reading? As Helene was saying, that the summit or its agenda or its outcome hasn't been widely covered in local press. So what is your interpretation of that?
Yeah, I mean, I actually take that as a positive. I mean, I think anytime you set up big expectations, especially in this part of the world in terms of regional cooperation kind of outcomes, inevitably there's a disappointment, right? Because it's about process, it's about symbolism. And to me, the greatest sort of takeaway here was, you know, Nazarbayev talking about how this is going to be essentially a regional format. Right? That's going to be independent of other formats. And really what he's saying is that you know, this is going to be something beyond, you know, the participation of the other sort of great powers and interested parties. And, you know, we had, I think the last summit was 9-10 years ago. And I think it's worth reflecting sort of over the last decade, we've seen a lot of regional formats and regional integration projects pushed, but they've usually been associated with an external power, right? Whether it's sort of Eurasian Economic Union, whether it's the Belt and Road, whether it's the U.S. and, you know, its attempts to sort of link, you know, Central Asia and South Asia or the NDN, you know, there's always a kind of interested party pushing integration on its own terms. And so to me, to have a regular format that's institutionalized, where it's just the regional powers that participate, I think is, you know, is intriguing. And, you know, cooperation is difficult in international relations. So that, to me, that's not as important as a sort of, you know, let's get back to the region and see if there's the potential to get things done.
Perhaps, Luca, we can continue with you in this exciting days that the Central Asian leaders again started talking to each other in the same room, but the Turkmen president was not there. I was reading Bruce's earlier rundown. The previous 5 or 6 gatherings that Central Asian leaders had in the same format over the past 27 years, I think, except when all of them organized in Turkmenistan. But this time, Berdimuhamedov decided not to come. As you know, some of the panelists in our previous Majlis discussion last week thought maybe it is because there is a parliamentary election coming in Turkmenistan, and also there is some financial difficulties in the country which requires Berdimuhamedov's attention. But at the end, we found out that he was not in Almaty, but in other foreign country, in Gulf. So what is your reading? Why he decided not to go to Kazakhstan? Instead went to Gulf countries, Kuwait and UAE.
Well, it clearly shows where his priorities are, doesn't it? To me, the fact that Berdimuhamedov went to the Gulf shows the fact that he needed to get some financial contacts there in the Gulf to address issues of, you know, if you want to think in a positive way, development of energy ties or investment to UAE. And if you want to think in a more pessimistic way, you're just getting some funds to cover up the trouble he has with either his economy or the Turkish company that left the country. So it seemed to me that his interests lie elsewhere. He may be either because he's not really interested in what they're doing in Astana, or because he thinks that Turkmenistan cannot benefit in any way, shape or form by that, which again raises the question, what do these leaders want from cooperation? And to me, it's very interesting that we keep saying that, you know, just the fact that they met is important. Because I like to see results. And maybe, I'm not justifying Berdimuhamedov, but we see many of these events in the past, and not much has followed. So you will really wonder, was he trying to tell us that this is more of the same? Was he making a statement, or just because of pragmatic politics? We'll see in the future, I guess.
That's very intriguing. Any other interpretation of that to the question that the reason why he decided to be in the Gulf instead of going to Almaty is a statement of some sort that, okay, this is another meeting, nothing is going to come out of that?
Well, I'm with Luca. I mean, it shows where his priorities are at the moment. He wanted to go somewhere where he thought he might get some financial help for his country first, and that was his bigger interest than going to this, you know, regional forum that they had going on there. I made the point in the paper, too, that for what it's worth, you know, he did send a delegation with the second, constitutionally, the second most powerful person in the country, and that doesn't mean very much in Turkmenistan, but you know, so it wasn't total disinterest. You know, he could have just stayed out of it entirely. You know, during the days of the Central Asian Union and later Central Asian Economic Union, Turkmenistan did stay out of those organizations.
But again, the format of those meetings were a little bit different, right? The agenda, the objective.
Yeah, well, you know, but at the same time, under Niyazov, he said that economic cooperation was really all Turkmenistan was interested in, and he wouldn't go to economic cooperation meetings with his neighbors, you know. So it was, you know, Berdimuhamedov didn't show up, but it wasn't like Turkmenistan was not there entirely. Although, you know, it was pretty sad to see those end of the summit pictures yesterday with four presidents standing in front of their flag and nobody standing in front of the Turkmen flag. I thought at least they would bring Akça Nurberdiyeva out there to stand with them. Maybe she was worried she'd be arrested when she got back to Ashgabat. I don't know. I'm not so pessimistic about that. I mean, I doubt that Turkmenistan would ever be a strong participant in this regional forum, but if they just keep a hand in it, it would be more than they've done since 1999.
There's also takeaways in terms of Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan I would like to discuss. But before getting into that, let's clear another question on Turkmenistan. Now, very suspicious meeting, actually, to be polite, I should say very surprised meeting between President Berdimuhamedov's son, Serdar, who was also happened to be present there, in fact, part of the delegation. Serdar is meeting with Nazarbayev ahead of the Central Asian Summit in Almaty. It was indeed intriguing to me why Nazarbayev chose to meet him, though the head of the delegation, as Bruce, you were saying, was the Speaker of the Turkmen Parliament. I know we're kind of getting beyond our topic. So what was happening there? Who wants to take this question? Maybe Alex?
I am not going to speculate on that, no. Maybe Luca has some insights,
Sure, yeah, Luca?
Yeah, look, I wouldn't read that much into it. I don't think it's the first step towards succession. I don't think that, you know, we can speculate beyond that. I mean, I would be really surprised if Berdimuhamedov's power is so strong at the moment that he can impose his son over anyone else in the elite. I would be very surprised. So, I mean, it's choreographic. These people like, you know, big pictures and photo ops. It's very choreographic, but I wouldn't really think much beyond justified it. He's surprised, yes, and Nazarbayev met with Serdar. But ultimately, it's just doing a favor to your counterpart, I guess. I wouldn't really speculate that much, but I don't read that many implications to what happened there.
I think this at least proves one thing, Bruce, maybe addresses your earlier question. Now, why there was no one present in the final photo op of the gathering, how Akça Nurberdiyeva could stand there when Berdimuhamedov's son was among the delegation. Anyway, so coming to summit, it appears that the Nazarbayev and Jeenbekov of Kyrgyzstan was satisfied from the summit or from outcome of their bilateral meeting I think they have had during the discussion. I read the headline somewhere yesterday saying that all the bilateral issues resolved between these two nations, which was mess, to say the least, after Atambayev's standoff with Nazarbayev. So what have you been hearing, Helene, on this front?
I think these issues, they don't make the headlines so much right now in Kazakhstan. Those, at least, yeah, very local or localized, they're regional issues. But, yeah, as you said, the relations... When the relations were at the very low, yeah, during the Kyrgyz election last year, this made the headline very often in Kazakhstan. People were discussing it, but also not only in the media, but also it has some kind of resonance also in the society. So people were discussing those issues. But again, today, I'm not sure. Yeah, this has a lot of echo in the society and also in political circles.
Alex, just a kind of related question to that. So what does this renewed relations between Nazarbayev and Jeenbekov means for Kyrgyzstan's local political dynamics? Things are moving to some direction. Hard to figure out what is happening, like the chief of the presidential staff was fired recently, and then whether there's any connection or not, then Prime Minister Isakov fired his own chief of staff. And there appears to be some cracks in the alliance between Atambayev and Jeenbekov. And on the other hand, you see Nazarbayev and Jeenbekov is improving their ties, and they have seen a number of photo ops during the summit. So what does those kind of apparently warming up relations between Nazarbayev and Jeenbekov means to Kyrgyzstan's local political dynamics?
Well, I would say that there's two new figures, right, at the summit. Jeenbekov and Mirziyoyev, we haven't talked about, right? But I think solidifying the relationship on both fronts is an absolute priority for Jeenbekov, right? And really strengthens his hand domestically to be able to show in both dealings with Kazakhstan that it hit such difficulties in the pre-election season, and where you literally had the border that's supposed to be open sort of jam-packed and being used sort of for punitive reasons on the part of the Kazakhs and so forth, that you're seeing movement on improving connections and border outcomes in both of these areas.
Yeah.
And Kyrgyzstan has been sandwiched, you know, relations with Uzbekistan had obviously been, you know, very poor for a long time.
Yeah.
So if he takes the prospect of real ground level ease of, you know, mobility and allowing potential, you know, some new sort of travel connections to be established, bus linkages, you know, this kind of thing, then I think that's actually quite a tangible outcome that he can sort of take back and demonstrate, you know, some sort of value, some sort of worth. And, you know, I would say, you know, the Uzbek part of this we haven't talked about, but I think this is really the big part of this too, right? That there is a chance now to reset the tone.
Yeah.
Again, always being, you know, cynical and cautious about these regional summits, but, you know, with Karimov, it had gotten to the point, right, where everything was an affront on his sovereignty, right, on his authority. There were enemies everywhere, you know? And so to sort of get past that, I think is more important than just sort of, you know, symbolism, right? I think there's like, you know, kind of a, to have some sort of functioning regional dialogue track. And then, of course, it's in Nazarbayev and Mirziyoyev's interest, too, to sort of present themselves as, you know, the two top powers in the region, right? Also, I mean, I think that's the underlying current of this, too, right? And Zhenbekov's, you know, perfectly happy to sort of, you know, relate to them and see how he's getting things, you know, Roman, too. But I think that's the other subcurrent here, that you have these kinds of, you know, it's, yes, it's in Astana, but there's a warm welcome to the, you know, new Uzbek president. And, you know, it's going to be Astana and Tashkent that runs this agenda going forward. Not Moscow, not Beijing, not Washington, right? And I think, to me, that's what I took out of the optics of this.
Luca, it was also subject of your discussions the other week in Washington, D.C., the Uzbek factor here, the fact that Mirziyoyev was, as Alex mentioned, was the initiator behind this summit, although it happened in Almaty. So what was Mirziyoyev's takeaway from this?
Look, I think that this is the big factor in Central Asia. I mean, if the summit is more the same, and it is compared to 15, 20 years ago, the backdrop against which the summit happens is totally changed. In the last 16 months, we've seen politics from below changing in terms of integration. We've got, Alex mentioned, bus, train, air links, new sort of energy deals, water cooperation. So this is a new time for the region. And it's a new time because Mirziyoyev brought back Uzbekistan into the fold. You can't really talk about integration in Central Asia if the state that share, the only state that share borders with the other four, is not playing the game. So which makes the Turkmenistan refusal all the more puzzling. So I think that Mirziyoyev is setting the tone for a new regional integration cooperation framework. He has been actually doing it in practice more than works, more than words. We've seen that in the last 16 months. So I think that the fact that they decide to meet annually is a testimony to the effort that he has been putting into this kind of of action. Just one final point of this. I think that if they continue with this kind of, I call it connectivity from below, so, you know, like low level, then we could test the progress of these meetings in a more, if you want, fair way. Because we're not talking about the big things of the past, unified economic space, commission for that, unified television, we heard in 94 about that. Here we're talking about states that are located in the same region, they want to have a meaningful cooperation in trade, movement of people, and eventually also in capital investment. If that happens, then the summit will become actually meaningful instrument to measure how the integration is going.
Also, let's see whether it repeats in Tashkent as they are planning next year. So, Helene, Rahman is back to Tajikistan. What he is saying to the people there that he brought from summit?
Well, again, I think the interesting thing about this new, this renewal of the friendship between all the Central Asian countries is that I think Tajikistan can benefit a lot from this. And we have seen already in the last 2 weeks, as you mentioned, I think the important factor here is the Uzbek president, who is interested in engaging with the other leaders, with the other countries. And there were significant developments between Tajikistan and Uzbekistan last week already when Mirziyoyev visited Tajikistan, and they actually change, as you as the Alexander and Luca already mentioned, those very important movements, yeah, that affect the lives of people, yeah. Those it's a top down approach to development, of course. These are important infrastructure developments, but the issue of engaging in trade and in opening spaces for trade and for people to travel between Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, they have actually intended, yeah, to abolish the visa regime between Uzbekistan and Tajikistan. Yeah. And this is extremely significant.
Yeah.
For everyone, in for ordinary citizens, and especially for a greatly needed in economic integration of the region, which we should emphasize that is one of the least integrated regions in the world in terms of trade and exchanges. And this is something that other, yeah, we could say, and I say this in bracket, yeah, post-colonial countries actually face, yeah, so this articulation between the former republics of Central Asia, that is very problematic. And I think while this summit, yeah, of course, is important for Tajikistan, Rahmon can actually claim, yeah, that he's also championing regional cooperation. So by making progress with the Uzbek president, his Uzbek counterpart, but also with the rest, engaging with the rest of Central Asia.
Right. It's a kind of a big picture question. Maybe, Alexey, you will be in a better position to answer this. In the light of all these warming ups in Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan coming out as a leading countries behind this movement, when Moscow looking at this renewed enthusiasm among Central Asian leaders to work together, what they see happening?
It's an excellent question. Frankly, I don't think it's very good news for Moscow. They'll never say this sort of publicly, right? And of course, they want, you know, to steer Uzbekistan back into a more Moscow-friendly path, right? And I think this is, you know, one of the trends too. Sort of, can Moscow regain a foothold? You know, there's been some speculation that, you know, Usmanov is effectively the de facto envoy going in between them. But again, it gets back to this question of integration on whose terms, right? And so, you know, Lavrov, I think it was a few weeks ago, had a, you know, kind of a very interesting, almost paranoid aside on U.S. policy towards Central Asia. It's going to be the same kind of destructive geopolitical obsessions in the past. And he was referring to sort of, you know, the kind of Trump administration's willingness to keep this sort of C5 plus one format out there. Now, I don't think anyone seriously think that a lot comes out of the C5 plus one format, right? It's sort of, you know, just sort of purely symbolic. And, you know, my sense is that the Trump administration is interested in, you know, keeping it and steering it towards security cooperation on Afghanistan, right? I don't think there's any kind of meaningful push to sort of encourage regional integration. But it does show that for Moscow, you know, the symbolism of who speaks for the region is very important, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, whose sphere of influence this is. And I think, you know, that's the underlying backdrop here, that, you know, these Eurasian initiatives, which I think are significant, they're not just symbolic, as I think some colleagues in the West sort of believe, especially the Eurasian Economic Union and the CSTO. But at the same time, I think it's very nervous at the prospects of kind of, you know, regional self-help, so to speak, right? So I think there's also a sense, you know, Moscow doesn't like it, but they're not going to pretend publicly that they don't.
Although you say that, Alex, but I think the timing was kind of strange, and wondered whether it has any connection to the summit or this warming up relationships between Central Asian leaders or not. I'm referring to Lavrov's comments that I have seen yesterday, saying that Kazakhstan needs approval from Eurasian Economic Union to continue to keep providing visa-free entry to the U.S. citizens. Isn't kind of indirect response reflecting Moscow's displeasure about what's happening in Central Asia, or it has nothing to do with that?
Indirectly, I would caution reading too much into it. But again, I think this is a good example of, you know, how Moscow views the Eurasian Economic Union, and perhaps Elena has some thoughts on this versus how Kazakhstan views it, right? And so for Moscow, it is this mechanism to try and coordinate and synchronize policy, and in some cases make policy kind of an exclusive purview of the EU, which, you know, de facto is led and governed by Moscow, versus for some of the participants where it's, you know, a system of encouraging economic exchange, but they all know it's really important to Moscow, and, you know, they want to join it while at the same time giving up as least amount of sovereignty as is possible. So I thought, you know, the visa regime spat, which I think you picked up on, Mohammed, is a really good example of that. And of course, you know, the Kazakhs have gone to great lengths to build a good relationship with the Trump administration, I think for many different reasons, which we can get into maybe another different podcast. And so, yeah, I think you picked up on a source of friction there, but I wouldn't say, you know, I think this is more of a concern about the continuing spiraling deterioration in U.S. Russian relations, really, than anything else.
Yeah. Okay.
Can you just jump in a second?
Sure.
I want to make a point about Kazakhstan. I think it's probably Nazarbayev is the most interesting actor there, not because of what he's do or what he's doing, but because of what he hasn't done. I think that this summit, which flies on the back of all the policy that Mirziyoyev implemented, really asks a question to Nazarbayev. What does it mean to be a Eurasianist in the later year of your mandate, in the late Nazarbayev year? How is the evolution of Kazakhstani Eurasianism actually clash with this return to Central Asia? Because if we look at the past, being Eurasian meant different things at different times, being post-Soviet, being Western with be located in Asia, but it never meant being purely Central Asia for Kazakhstan. So in that sense, I always consider Kazakhstan to be quite alien to regional cooperation. But now that the things are changing and there is clear benefits trading more and investing more in your neighbor's economy, what is Nazarbayev going to do? Is he going to cooperate with this system? Is he going to take a step back because it's maybe too old? Or is he going to challenge Mirziyoyev? I think this is clear. I mean, someone mentioned before the fact, well, I think it was Alex that mentioned the fact you got these two big players regionally trying to do something together. I think that Central Asia cooperation will only increase if these two states actually start to do work together. If that happens, then again, this could be a good start. Otherwise, it's more to say.
Interesting. Thank you very much, Luca, for bringing us back to this summit. So, as I said earlier, yesterday I was reading Bruce's background analysis on earlier gatherings of Central Asian leaders. It appears that they were discussing, as Bruce, you mentioned, the same agenda items for, I think, 27 years ago when they met first time in Ashgabat. In the light of this, let's take a look into the history of these gatherings to figure out where it is headed going forward. Hey, everyone. Before we get into the second part of the show, just a quick reminder that if you really like Majlis Podcast, there's a real chance that you will also like my other radio show that's called Gandhara Podcast. The show discusses latest developments in Pakistan and Afghanistan from local perspective. And the podcast is published in every second week on Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty's Gandhara website. It's a totally must-follow discussion for foreign policy nerds with interest in the region. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia podcast, we are discussing the outcome of the recent Central Asian Leaders Summit. Joining me in the discussion are Alex Cooley, Director of Harriman Institute at the Columbia University, Luca Ancheschi, Chairman of Central Asia Studies Center at the University of Glasgow, Helen Thibault, a Political Science Lecturer at the Nazarbayev University, Bruce Panier, Editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owasi. I am Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, colleagues. Now that the leaders in Central Asia are, you know, discussing almost the same topics after 27 years, as Bruce, you mentioned earlier, maybe we can start with you. Behind the momentum, there are deep divisions based on many problematic issues that was kind of blocking the progress throughout these 27 years. So maybe we should look into these questions province, these problematic areas, item by item. So let's begin with the water sharing. So what is the actual problem there, Bruce, and what is blocking the solution?
Let me start by saying, you know, that part of the problem is that what they agree on at these summits, it's easy for them to agree on this stuff at the summit, and then once they have to implement it, it's never easy at all. In the case of water, you know, obviously the two poorest countries in Central Asia are the ones with the water, and everyone needs the water. But traditionally, the countries with all the energy resources have been unwilling to share their energy resources with the two poor countries in exchange for water, which sounds like a perfect deal. And in fact, during the late 1990s, Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan had a deal with Kyrgyzstan that Kyrgyzstan would maintain the rivers and the reservoirs that fed water into the rivers going to Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. And in exchange, Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan would make energy resources available to Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan's gas and Kazakhstan's coal. And of course, that even broke down, you know, right away. It seems like it would be a simple agreement. But when it came time to implement it, it wasn't so simple. You know, again, with new leadership in Uzbekistan, it does change the way the situation looks. There might be a little bit more flexibility and a little bit more willingness on the part of the Uzbek side to talk about some of this stuff. Because, you know, again, it seems fair that if you have to maintain the water tributaries that go into the downstream countries, you should be compensated somehow for that. You know, and I know no one wants to suggest that you should charge for water. Kyrgyzstan has floated that idea a couple times. It's very unpopular. It's very dangerous to do that kind of thing. But there should be some way that they can come to some kind of agreement that would suit all the parties, where you get the water and then the countries that need the energy get their part of the energy. They mentioned it a lot, but of course, you know, this was the first meeting, you know, the summit yesterday. So that while they talked about it, as they have in the past, they didn't come up with any solutions. But again, I think there's a lot of goodwill there that just wasn't present previously.
Bruce, you mentioned the need for flexibility and possibility of flexibility on the Uzbek side. What that flexibility you think is going to look like? And also, kind of side question to that, like this water issue was a tense throughout the history between Uzbekistan and Tajikistan. Uzbekistan has, it became kind of a red line for them over the past years during the Karimov time. How Mirziyoyev is going to explain any flexibility he will show to people in Uzbekistan in terms of their position on the water?
Well, I mean, he's already hinted that some of the policies of the previous administration were not conducive to regional cooperation. So, you know, he's kind of set the table for the fact that he's going to go back on some of Karimov's policies. You know, for what it's worth, Uzbekistan has said that it would like to participate in both the big hydropower projects, the one in Kyrgyzstan, Kambarata, and the one in Tajikistan, the Ragun hydropower plant. Ragun is going to be launched at the end of this year anyway. So it's late in the game to, like, jump on board, but it does give Uzbekistan, if they're really going to go through with this and help out financially and perhaps with materials, it does give them some say, and if nothing else, they can watch and see how the project is progressing and how much water is going through and coming down into Uzbekistan. You know, that said, I think Mirziyoyev is going to have to bite the bullet on some of this stuff. The reason that he's so worried about water, the reason Karimov was so worried about water, is because Uzbekistan is addicted to cotton, and cotton is a thirsty crop, and they have to ditch it if they want to get this through. If they would find another way, another crop to replace cotton or to the greatest extent possible, they would solve a lot of the water problems already in the region.
On energy, Alex, maybe you would like to jump in here. On energy, energy sharing problem that Central Asia is facing, especially when there is a tough winter. So what is the solution you see to solve that problem, and where the solution is going to come out? What kind of compromises we are talking about to resolve this issue?
Ooh. That's a tough one, Mohammed. I'm not sure if there's a silver bullet single solution. What I think there is the possibility of going back to a system where in times of crisis or emergency or even seasonally, that there could be a system of norms, of barter, of understandings, right, that promotes, you know, some sort of regional cooperation and power sharing, really. And I'm not saying going back to all of the informal Soviet era agreements, but getting away from this idea that every country has to provide its own energy for its own purposes, right, that we had gotten into, you know, over the last period of the post-Soviet era. So I think, you know, this Uzbek, Tajik, some of that Elena talked about, and that Bruce flag, it's incredibly important, right? I mean, if you can actually get some sort of understanding that Rogun gets built, but in exchange, you know, we have some sort of say, some sort of, you know, set of inputs into, you know, the rhythm of sort of water management and usage, you know, I think that can become the basis for a lot of other types of sort of informal understandings. But I think in this particular case, sort of the energy issue is tied to sort of norms and informal cooperation and side payments. And so changing the tone, changing the atmosphere, I think potentially creates the framework for a patchwork of local solutions. I don't think there's any, you know, magical silver bullet that's going to solve the real energy shortages and demand side of the equation.
Hmm. Luca, do you want to jump in here? You are our energy expert. So
I think that Alex was perfectly right. What has happened in the last 16 months actually created a new environment for energy cooperation. Hmm. I mean, having Mirziyoyev going into Tajikistan, going into Kyrgyzstan, going even into Turkmenistan, and strike oil deals, gas deals, actually shows that there is an understanding in the region, well, in Uzbekistan now, that cooperation has to be more actively pursued. It doesn't happen by magic. It's in the longer term Soviet Union. You need to work for that. And it seems also to me that we are now moving into this time of reintegration, even in electricity, which is crucial because a region that does not even have a shared grid can hardly be called a region. So I'm actually, surprisingly for myself, optimistic on this thing. I think that we've seen enough indicators that there is a movement towards a more shared security framework in the energy. What I'm not sure, and it goes back to the point Alex was making, is how close we are to set a new range of norms to regulate this energy market in Central Asia. That could take a while, but in the meantime, we are seeing that bilaterally things are working better. And that's an encouraging development.
Okay. Now, earlier, Helene, you kind of hinted, and let's get into this, the security question here, the one that Nazarbayev was raising, that includes Afghanistan, ISIS, or Central Asian fighters. So although the names have changed, but they were talking about the same topic throughout those summits that started in 1991 in Turkmenistan. Why is that they cannot agree on any unified strategy on this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting question, because this is an issue that all Central Asian countries face. But at the same time, we, and as you know, of course, we always have to be careful with the actual threat, of radical Islam in Central Asia. So there's always a tendency for states, for governments to overemphasize, the existence of this threat. But this is something that is still a concern, and I think a genuine concern, for states. But interestingly, there's no integrated solution to this problem. But is there an integrated solution to other problems that Central Asia has, that countries of Central Asia have? So we have emphasized throughout this podcast, that there's really a lack of regional cooperation. The Eurasian Economic Union between some of the countries of Central Asia is a solution to this, especially to trade and movement of people. But at the same time, so I'm not surprised there isn't an integrated solution for issues of radicalism. Yet, there already are some institutions, regional institutions that tackle this issue. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization is mostly focusing on, as the name says, the security issues. And they've had joint exercises, military exercises. So there is an attempt between Central Asian countries, those that are members of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. So there are some attempts, to find global regional solutions, to the issue. But at the same time, something we haven't talked about a little bit, in this podcast is the role of China yeah, and the influence of China, because I think China is a very important player when we talk about regional cooperation and integration, and also for security issues, because China has a very important, powerful, and very authoritarian country, yeah, is very much concerned with security issues, and this is something, an issue that they China, yeah, is emphasizing, yeah, throughout its cooperation with Central Asian countries.
Okay, thank you very much. We are already over time, but there are a couple of other points I wanted to discuss. Okay, let's finalize this. Now that the leaders met, they discussed a couple of difficult issues. Now, what is that we should be looking for to determine what the future for this new found alliance is going to look like going forward? Maybe Bruce, then with the other member of the panel.
Economically speaking, we have to see how easy it is for goods and people to move throughout the region back and forth without any obstacles like we saw in the for years and years at the border. And in terms of security, we're not really going to know until something actually happens. Historically, they were all agreed that something needed to be done. And then when something happened, they couldn't agree on exactly how they should confront it. And even to this day, there are different views on how much of a security threat Afghanistan is. If you ask Tajikistan, they would say it's pressing and we need to do something about it now. And of course, they've enlisted outside help from Russia and China. Uzbekistan considers it a threat, but it's got a very short border with Afghanistan, and a country like Turkmenistan doesn't really see that it's an immediate threat to them. At least publicly, they're not going to say that, and they would prefer to negotiate. And we know that for the last couple of years, they already have been talking to the Taliban again. As far as security, we won't know until something happens, but certainly in the coming weeks and months, we ought to be able to see, is this really working? Can goods and people transit across borders easily, like they say that they're going to do, or are we going to encounter new obstacles?
Mm-hmm. On the same question, Alex, maybe behind this excitement, so what are the steps that we should be looking at to determine where this renewed relationship is heading going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I would support all of those that Bruce has flagged. And in general, I think, a lack of drama surrounding this, I think, is a good sign, right? I think, the fact that this has been not covered in some of the countries as, a kind of, a game-changing, high-stakes moment is good. I think these interactions, they need to be routinized, and they need to be viewed as, part of the natural bottom-up flow of how countries within regions and areas within regions sort of relate to one another. As Bruce said, I don't think it's possible to go back to this sort of late Soviet and immediate post-Soviet sort of era where you still had, great mobility and informal norms governing these different sort of, border areas. But certainly, I think gaining a perspective of what especially private actors in conjunction with local authorities need, right, in these bottom areas, and finding a mechanism then if there are problems through which these issues can be resolved, either in these new, more robust kind of, bilateral relations or within a future format, that's the challenge, right? So not top down, like we will now have cooperation, but rather what are the obstacles that are coming up, right? What's the clash of legal regimes or understandings or, frankly, sort of, political interests and bureaucracies, and can there be a mechanism through which then these interests, these sort of disputes get mitigated going forward? And in some ways, I think that's a very mundane thing. If a mechanism like that starts to happen and we start to get just these types of interactions, then maybe it won't even rise to the level of a regional summit. But all that, I think, will be much more organic and much more healthy for the region.
Okay. Luca and then Helene. So, Luca, what are some of the concrete items that you are looking at that will determine where these new alliances are heading going forward?
Well, look, if I would be very happy if this summit becomes a yearly checkpoint to see how things are going on the ground. If the leaders stop making big promises, huge expectation raised after that, I would be very happy. I mean, it seemed to me that doing things the way in which Medvedev has been doing in terms of regional cooperation has been more mature than what we see in the 90s, where every summit was either a policy reboot or a policy reset or a new EU and Central relationship. If we have, and Alex is right talking about the fact that this has to be regular. So if you got this calendarization of meetings, then you just take stock of what's happening in the 12 months. And since the bilateral cooperation is going much better, it seemed to me that we can be optimistic at least for the next 12 months. But, you know, all it takes is a new leader somewhere, and the balance had to be readdressed again.
Hmm. Okay. Final comments, Helen?
Yes, I guess I should reiterate what my colleagues have been saying about this. The concrete implementation of future meetings, but at the same time, there are already other forums where these countries can cooperate. Some of them, yeah. So Tajikistan is planning on joining maybe the Eurasian Economic Union. So that would be a plus, for them. Another platform on which they can foster cooperation regionally. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization is another one, and of course the CSDO is another one. So it's true that there's a multiplication of different forums, and I don't know if this regional, specifically Central Asian cooperation will be institutionalized. It is not impossible, but I don't see it as something very likely in the near future.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Helen Thibault, political science lecturer at the Nazarbayev University in Kazakhstan. Also, big thanks goes to Alex Cooley, director of Harriman Institute at Columbia University in New York, Luka Ancheschi, chairman of Central Asia Studies Center at the University of Glasgow, and Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, Kishlok Awazi. Thank you, colleagues, for your time and thoughts today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was very nice to have you. And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis, Radio for Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia podcast. Until next week, bye-bye.